The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 20% off during the month of September.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. This month's guest is Jhumpa Lahiri, who came in to talk about her short story collection, Unaccustomed Earth. Lahiri won a Pulitzer Prize for her novel, The Namesake, and is on the Man Booker shortlist this year with her latest, The Lowland. We'll be hearing more from her about that in a couple of weeks. But it was as a short story writer that she first made her mark. Book Club host John Mullen felt one remarkable feature of Unaccustomed Earth was how well the stories hung together. So he asked Lahiri if she had deliberately written them as a collection.
Before I started writing The Namesake, that is just after I finished my first collection and knew that it was going to be a collection and a book and published and all of that, I started working with Hema and Kaushik, the characters who appear in the last three stories in the book. And I was trying to work with them possibly for a novel. Mm. I wasn't sure exactly what was going to happen. But I thought of them, they came to me as characters and their general situation. They were the son and daughter of two families who were very close at one point and then were physically separated for a period and then come back together but aren't as emotionally close. So I started working with them. This would have been 1998. And just trying to sniff my way around, you know, this is how I think how at least I start with something. I just sort of start circling around an idea, some characters, a situation. So I worked with them for a while. I saw them very clearly and in one way, and in another way they remained opaque and impenetrable. And so I set it aside. I set them and their life and their nascent story aside. And I went on to write The Namesake. So then I went back to Hema and Kaushik. I still wanted to work with them. I felt that I knew them better and I saw them more clearly. And I wrote the first of the stories in what now one could call a trilogy, the trilogy at the end of the book. You know, I felt very, very strongly that it was a short story, that I wasn't interested in working with them in a novel format. It didn't interest me. I wanted to, I saw a way to tell that story as a story, and so I did. But then, for the first time in my life, ever as a writer, I felt inspired to move on, not away from the characters. Usually I finish a story and I never want to think about them again. But in this case, I did continue to think about them, and I because Once in a Lifetime is written in that Hema addressing Kaushik, I felt that in a way it called for a response, and because the story ends where it does, I also felt that, well, I believe it's a complete story, but in another way, obviously, there's another shoe that has to drop in terms of the mother and Kaushik and his life and what happens there. So I decided to write a second story, and that was a very interesting process and a new kind of move for me as a writer. It felt exciting to work with the same characters but shift the point of view and move forward in time. And then once I had written the second story, in the middle of writing the second story, I felt that just for the sake of structure and cohesion, that there had to be a third story. So that I wrote relatively quickly compared to the others. So that's a sort of an explanation for those last three stories in the book, which are, they form a whole. But all of the other stories, I agree with you. I mean, I think in a way they're all dimensions of one world, one idea, one basic situation that I'm looking at from different angles and from down here and up there and around the corner. I mean, there's sort of variations. I think this book is a little bit, for me, what certain landscapes are to certain painters, you know, and they keep going to them at different times of day, and they paint them in the middle of the night, and they paint them at noon, and they paint them at twilight, and they paint it in winter, and they're drawn to it, but in these different, with these different filters. And I feel like the stories in this collection were that for me, in that I was looking at, you know, what happens as this first generation of immigrants, largely from Calcutta, arrive in New England, and not the initial experiences so much, but moving forward in time. I think, you know, a story like Hell Heaven begins at the beginning and then moves forward in time, so that you have the span of that first generation really coming of age and becoming an adult. Another thing I could add too, Only Goodness and Unaccustomed Earth, which are now two different stories, started as one story.
Because Only Goodness is the alcoholic.
Yes, Only Goodness is the alcoholic brother, and Unaccustomed Earth is the, there's a brother and sister in that story as well, but the brother has been shipped off to New Zealand or someplace. It was just a groaning plate of too many things, too many problems, too many issues. Every sibling was, you know, having a crisis of some sort, and so I had to just take scissors in my head and cut away a whole aspect of that family and create a new family, you know.
I mean, it feels as if a short story, for you anyway, and for your reader, therefore, is a way of taking sort of one important thing. The short story is a really a sort of satisfying way of taking, I don't know, almost something that might get lost in a novel or be incidental, and saying just this.
Yes, and I think that's what I love about short stories, is that it really allows me as a writer, but also as a reader, when I read short stories, to really go in deep and focus and linger over something that could be incidental on a larger canvas. And I like that, you know, I like getting as close as possible to my characters and to their dilemmas, their conflicts. I think that's really the best way to understand them and to get your mind around them. But I think mainly it's because I love to read short stories. I've always loved to read short stories, and I derive a certain pleasure from them. They give me a unique satisfaction as a reader. I've never thought of them as a lesser form or diminutive from the point of view of reading. I feel that in the ideal world, you have both Chekhov and Tolstoy, and no one should ever make you choose. You know, they do different things, and they each do them brilliantly.
It gives the ending a special weight. In the first story, the story ends with the daughter discovering from the postcard that her father actually has another life, and posting it for him. And what might be an incident in a bigger book becomes the point.
These smaller moments and gestures and actions, exactly. I mean, I think a novel couldn't sustain just that. But again, I don't mean to say just that, but it, you know, sometimes the smallest gestures and moments and meanings and exchanges have such enormous power. And I think even in the scope of writing a novel, you know, which has sort of more powerful engines in a way driving it. But for me, you know, I never want to lose sight of those smaller moments, because I think they speak, they communicate so much, they express so much in the end, whether in a novel or in a short story. But I think in a short story, yes, I mean, that smaller moment, that gesture can claim a significance, a centrality that allows the reader to really focus on it, to contemplate it, and what does that mean?
Several of them have that sort of quality, that what the ending does is, and sometimes it's realizing something about the parents in a story. I mean, the first of the three stories, he reveals something about his parents, who are apparently these slightly intrusive, gin-swigging kind of people who come into the narrator's life, and he suddenly reveals something right at the end, which makes her, but therefore you, also reassess what's gone before.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, and that was an interesting story to figure out also, because of course, when I was first working with Hema and Kaushik all those years ago, you know, all I knew was the premise, only so far, insofar as, you know, they had been close, and then one family moves away, and then they come back again, and they're living in close quarters for a while, and one mother is having a strong, somewhat negative reaction to the other mother who's gone back to India for a while, but has in fact returned much more westernized and, you know, quote unquote, sort of sophisticated, worldly, as a result of her time in India. But I didn't know that she was dying. For many years, as I was working on these characters and getting to know them, I myself didn't know as a writer. So I think once I did know that that's why they came back, and that it was to, you know, for the wife's medical treatment, and this was the whole situation, and that it was loaded, so heavily loaded for them as a family, it was a shock to me also. For so much of the process, I am in the dark,
right?
You know, and I am having to figure out what is happening and why it's happening.
There's another sort of motivational thing that fascinated me, which is very particular to one of the stories that we haven't talked about, which is a story I really enjoyed called A Choice of Accommodations. It's about Amit and his wife Megan, and they go to a wedding. He goes off to make a phone call, but he's drunk and he falls asleep and tired and he falls asleep. And he leaves her to the tender mercies of this kind of circling, slightly older man who looks like he's a sort of practice seducer of drunk men's wives at weddings. And you fear for the worst. And when Amit wakes up, it's the next morning. And he said he was just coming back and his wife's not there. And he fears the worst. Everything's wrong, they missed the breakfast, it's bad weather, da 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 da. But weirdly, logically, their sort of amorous voltage is rekindled by the strange place they're in, you know.
They connect to one another in some way, though I don't think it's a problem solver,
no.
That moment, that particular encounter between them. I think the marriage is complicated, and he's complicated, and he has issues with himself and hasn't quite sorted them out. So he remains, I think, troubled as a character. But I can say a bit about how that story came around. This happens to me often. I mean, I went to a wedding once with my husband and our son, who was then very young. And I think it was one of the first social events that we attended as parents, you know, and it was all very nerve-wracking, taking a train and having a baby and staying in a hotel with a baby and everything. I remember it very vividly. And so we went to the wedding, and it happened to be held on the grounds of a boarding school, because my friend who was getting married is the daughter of the headmaster of the school at the time. Our experience of the wedding was very restricted and limited. You know, we went early, we left very early. You know, we had the baby, you know, sort of on us. And I remember walking home long before the dancing and all of these things even happened. And then the next morning we did wake up and it was raining. We said, well, let's go have the brunch. And of course we had slept through the brunch. And so I remember that experience of wandering around this boarding school for an hour, looking and following these signs and arrows and this and that, and then never, and then, and in the process getting a very vivid picture of this school, which it was a Sunday morning in July or something, you know, just abandoned. And I didn't go to a school like that, so it was all exotic to me to even be exploring, and felt kind of almost like we were trespassing. And then finally we discovered that, of course, we were 2 hours late and the couple had left for their honeymoon, and I just felt so pathetic. Somehow in the process of that morning, I began to have one of these strange out-of-body experiences, which happens to me with some regularity. I think it's called being a writer, in which I became not myself, but that character. And I had gone to the school, and I was coming back, and I found myself wandering around the brunch, and the child wasn't there, and it was a spouse, and I remember, you know, what I did was I took some of the hotel, the notepad thing that you had that's in the hotel, and I started writing down sort of the beginning of the story. And I actually didn't work on the story for some time. And it's funny because my experience of the wedding, my real experience of the wedding, is so radically different from his experience, in which I didn't drink anything. You know, I was breastfeeding. I left at 8 o'clock at night. You know, my husband and I came back together because we had the baby and had to, you know, put the baby to bed and all these things. But so often stories for me grow out of that intersection of, you know, something I'm, you know, a place I go or something I know in some way from experience, and yet there's a sort of alternate reality that takes over, and an alternate, you know, it all starts with character, right? So what do you do in this setting that you know with a character you don't know, and then you have to get to know in the writing process and put him into play? But then there are these little elements that then will inform the character, you know. I mean, the fact that I was at the school, I thought, oh, well, maybe he should have gone to this school, and so that his going there will be all the more loaded and charged because it's where he spent, you know, some part of his, you know, adolescence, and what were his experiences then, versus, you know, for me it was just, oh, I've never set foot on the campus of an American boarding school, and how fascinating anthropologically to be looking at all of this. And whereas for him, it's a totally different thing, you know.
I must give everybody else a chance before I force you to go through each one of your stories.
Who are your top three short story writers? What do you like about them, and how are they different from each other?
I mean, certainly William Trevor, taught me how to write short stories, really. He's unequaled in terms of his language and his compassion and how careful he is as a writer. I mean, I don't think any writer really is quite so careful, quite so both clean and precise, but with so much emotion. That is a very hard thing to do, really. And I have been so moved as a reader by his short stories. I mean, really, they're difficult to read, because they're so true, they're so painful. The way he enters into the emotional lives of his characters. Another short story writer, Mavis Gallant, who is an absolute genius and so wildly. I mean, she's just a kind of virtuoso in terms of what she does with the short story. I mean, I think Trevor takes the short story and perfects it in a way, in that classical mode. Whereas Mavis just takes it and turns it on its head, and does in a short story what, you know, novelists try but fail to do so often. Wild leaps and bounds and mysterious turns. I mean, it's really like reading her is, you know, it's a bit of a roller coaster ride, and you don't know where you are and where you're going, and yet somehow it's all of a piece. Her stories are amazing in that I never remember what in the world happens in them, which is incredible, you know, because I just want to keep reading them and rereading them because they're so complex, they're so charged. And then Flannery O'Connor was very fundamental to me when I was first starting to write stories. I studied her very carefully in terms of, you know, character, really, above all, but also just all of the basic elements that she does so well, you know, dialogue, action, place, a gravity to the work, a complexity. This is what I really love about a short story. I mean, you know, none of these writers writes about incidental things or in an incidental way. I mean, they can be moments, they can be an exchange on a bus, they can be a tea party gone awry. And yet the significance is so, so deep, so resonant.
I was just thinking about your stories in the sense of the generational divide is quite apparent in a lot of your short stories. The parents are usually, they can be traditional, very cliquey, the Bengalis hanging out together, and the kids want to sort of break free of that somewhat. And then every now and again you get a character who bucks that trend. So you have, at the end of this collection, you've got the daughter who actually goes for that sort of arranged marriage. In terms of the feedback you've got from people of your parents' generation when they read your work, what kind of comments do they have?
I don't claim to describe a generation, really. I mean, I just think of my characters as individuals, and I draw obviously from a certain social landscape in which I was raised. But apart from that, I wouldn't be interested, but nor would I be able to represent a whole generation of, I mean, we're talking about hundreds and thousands of people, and there's no way to characterize that in any way, because we're all unique and we're all coming from our own particular set of experiences and predilections and that's what interests me about, I mean, for example, in the Hema and Kaushik series of stories, you know, it interested me to pit those two mothers against one another, because on the one hand, oh, well, they're just the same. I mean, they both come from Calcutta and they live in Boston or whatever, and they should just have everything in the world in common. But they don't, you know, because they're who they are. And that's what's always been important to me to express as a writer, because I think, you know, it's so easy to sort of assume, oh, well, you know, you come from over there and you do those things and think that way, and you just want your kids to have arranged marriages and whatever. And that may be a prevalent reality, but one can't generalize. And I fight against that. I'm opposed to that as a person and certainly as a writer.
Before I actually read the short stories, I was really drawn to the Hawthorne quotation you used at the beginning about striking roots into unaccustomed earth. Was it that quotation that sort of inspired you?
I was rereading The Scarlet Letter while working on these stories. I grew up in New England and I read it when I was, you know, 15 or whatever. When I read it this time, I had a physical reaction to encountering this passage, realizing that Hawthorne was expressing years before me, such century and a half ago, exactly what I was trying to do as a writer, in that I was exploring this very process of what unaccustomed earth is, the necessity, the importance, the challenge of uprooting and trying to reestablish oneself, one's life, one's family in new land. And for me, it was very intense because I was raised in New England as a child of immigrants. And when I was a child, when I was in high school, you know, reading an author like Hawthorne represented something to me, in that, you know, he represented the American literary tradition, light years away from my own family's particular experience in America, as outsiders, as recent arrivals, as very unrooted people.
So I'm wondering, do you have a trusted circle of friends, companions, mentors who kind of weigh in on you and not manage to leak it to the press?
Do you have readers?
I do, of course, yeah. I do. Every writer, I hope, has one or two or, you know, a few. You don't need many, but absolutely I've relied on the guidance, the honesty, the support of fellow writers, usually in the beginning, just to read something for me, tell me what it's doing, tell me if it's worth pursuing or not. And then eventually, you know, an editor will come into the picture, but I try to hold off on that for a while, because then it becomes a different thing, because an editor will look at the book in progress with an eye toward it becoming an actual book, finished book. Whereas I think when you show work in progress to other writers, they realize, they know that maybe this book won't end up being a book. And, you know, maybe this is a book to abandon. Maybe this is a story that, you know, is just, I mean, I remember a friend once told me, you've painted yourself into a corner. You're not going to get out of this. And she was right.
Hi, my background is African, and one of the things that always tickles me or strikes me about your work is how similar the immigrant's experience is. And I just wonder how aware you are of those shared cultural experiences when you're writing.
In the United States, because it's a country composed of so many immigrants of varying generations on the immigrant chain. It's been very, very gratifying to hear from other readers who come from different, ostensibly different backgrounds from my family, but to say, well, yes, I went through something like this, or my parents did, or my great-grandparents did, or my great-grandparents, but this is a part of our family experience as well. I think immigrant experiences, you know, being a foreigner can be in some ways a very isolating experience. One feels very alone. But I think when you look back, when you step back and sort of look at the world, especially today's world, you see how many people are moving around, have moved around, have shifted, have been displaced both by choice or by necessity. It's more common in a way to be approaching life with these questions, with these issues, with these challenges than not.
And thank you all very much for coming, for all your questions. And I'm sure you want me to thank Jhumpa.
Thank you.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you will get 20% off in September by going to squarespace.com and using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.